Welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill says officers were legally justified when they shot and killed Bernardo Palacios Carbajal. Lawyers for the family disagree with that assessment, as did the protesters who took to downtown Salt Lake City last night. Also, Utah Governor Gary Herbert institutes a mask mandate for K through 12 schools, but not for the state as a whole. And some lawmakers and businesses push for greater flexibility in state liquor laws during the pandemic. On the phone to discuss all of this, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jessica Miller. And good morning and welcome to you, Jessica.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for being here. And Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks for having me, Roger.
Of course. Good morning. A little bit later, we will also hear from the Tribune's Kathy Stevenson as well. And listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to us. The handle is at KCPW. All right. Well, Jessica Miller, you covered back-to-back press conferences yesterday. The first was a walkthrough of the police shooting and the announcement of a determination by the county DA, Sim Gill. And as I said in the introduction, Gill said that officers were justified when they shot Bernardo Palacios Carbajal as he fled from them. And we'll get to that determination. I kind of feel like we need, though, to remind everyone who's listening of the details of this case so that the follow-up makes sense. This all stems from the events of a night in late March, a 911 call, a lot of shots fired by police. Just remind us of what happened in the initial incident, Jessica.
Yeah, so the police encountered Bernardo after someone had called 911 and said that they had just been robbed by two men with guns. And so he was in the motel parking lot. They encountered him, and one officer yelled, "Show me your hands." And at that point, Palacios Carbajal started to run away, and the officers chased him for several blocks. And during this, you can see from the body camera footage that he stumbles and falls several times before getting up and continuing to run. And sometimes when he was doing the stumbling, he was dropping something, which police later found out to be a gun, and kept running. And so it was at the third time that he had kind of stumbled and fell where one of the police officers realized that the object he was dropping was a gun. And so that's when two of the officers began firing at Palacios Carbajal. He fell to the ground after being shot about six or seven times. And then there's a point where he kind of moves his body, kind of turns towards them. And that's when they believed that he was going to point the weapon at them. So they continued shooting, and they ended up firing 34 shots total at Palacios Carbajal.
Okay. And that is that's the sequence of events there. And then the kind of a little bit later, you know, as the district attorney is investigating this, because there was an investigation that was triggered immediately that is triggered with any police shooting. But the overall backdrop here, Jessica, is the national conversation and protests over police shootings or police killings, I should say, is the death that sparked this, that of George Floyd, wasn't a shooting. Mm-hmm. But protests have been ongoing. And here in Salt Lake City, this shooting has become the focus of these protests. That's the overall backdrop. Let's turn, though, to the district attorney's walkthrough of events that he did yesterday. This was a kind of expedited review. It happened faster than usual, in part because of those protests. Right, Jessica?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We actually did a little bit of like data analysis of how frequent or how often or how much time usually passes between his rulings. And this was done at about, you know, half the average time. So this is a lot quicker. And there's even some cases, you know, from as far back as 2018 that are still pending that he still hasn't ruled on. So this one kind of got pushed to the top of the pile of the other cases that are still pending.
Yeah, exactly. And then, as I said, the district attorney says that these two officers were justified in their actions. What evidence did he base that decision on, and what, legal standard, Jessica?
Says that an officer can use lethal force if they reasonably believe that their lives are in danger or the lives of someone else around them. And so the officers told investigators that, you know, that they had a fear that Palacios Carbajal could turn around and shoot them. This was 2 a.m., so it was very early in the morning, but this is also around the time there's a local strip club nearby, and the strip club was closing, and so people were leaving the bar, and so there were some people milling in the area, and so they said that their concern was that, you know, he was running away. They'd been in this area because they had just been told that someone had been robbed at gunpoint. They see he has a gun, and they're concerned that he could turn and shoot them and or could harm somebody else, and so Simgill, while looking at that explanation, ruled that that fits into the standard in simple law that says that you can use deadly force, a police officer can use deadly force if they believe their lives are in danger.
And this is something that obviously this is we hear this a lot in these cases because of that legal standard of reasonable. That's a difficult threshold for anyone who wants to pursue charges against an officer for them to surmount should they want to, pursue legal charges. I guess this is how the law is written, and this is basically what we hear in all of the cases of police shootings to date. Is that correct, Jessica?
Yeah, and you look at the history. I mean, there's only been three cases in the last decade that police officers have been charged. Simgill actually brought all of those cases. They all have been in Salt Lake County. Two of them, they ended up dropping before it kind of really got to the courtroom, before the facts could kind of play out in the courtroom. And then the third one was involving a police officer who shot a young woman, Danielle Willard, as she was backing out of a parking spot. And they believed that, or their theory was that he didn't have reasonable fear for his own safety. And they brought that case to court, and it was actually thrown out at a very early stage of the preliminary hearing stage, which it's really rare for a judge to dismiss a case at that level. So that kind of goes to show like how difficult these cases are, even if you have one that you really think the evidence is strong. It really hasn't gone past, you know, very preliminary stages in Utah courtrooms in the last decade.
And this is something that you and your colleague Peyton Harkins dug into the history of police shootings over the past decade. And in that article, you point out that police have shot at someone 185 times in the state of Utah since 2010. Almost all of those were considered legally justified, 92%. And then in three instances, they moved forward with prosecutions, but nothing. And then this one that actually made it to final prosecution. The other two were dismissed earlier or whatever. I don't know the exact details of it, but nothing is sticking. And I guess what I'm wondering is, are the district attorney's hands tied when it comes to whether or not he files charges? Is that a tough question to answer? I mean, does the law... I could pose that to Robert Gerke if that is a tough question to answer.
I think that Simgill has said as much, that it's the way the law is written, it's difficult for him to bring a case. And he's, you know, even talked about how this is a system that tends to favor police officers in the way that it's set up. That's just the way that it is. And I think that what we'll see in coming weeks is Simgill has said that he will propose some changes. I mean, obviously, he can't change the law. That's up to the legislators. But he would like to push for changes. We've seen the same sentiment from the mayor and other officials. It's something that's being debated, you know, at a federal level as well. So I think that this conversation about whether we should change the statute and tweak they call it the reasonableness standard, like whether it's reasonable to believe that your safety was at risk. I think we'll see that discussion continue in the coming weeks and months ahead.
Okay. And that's something that Robert Gerke, columnist, wrote about as well in a column. And I want to get to that. I also want to get to the response of the family, but maybe I will bring Robert Gerke in on this point for just a second. Robert, 185 shootings since 2010. That is not quite, 20 shootings a year by Utah police. Obviously, there are instances in which the police have to fire their weapons. Less than 20 instances per year in which that happened in the past decade. I don't know. Is that good? Is that bad? Does the number itself mean anything? What's your take on just the prevalence of police shootings in Utah?
Well, I mean, there is a group that tracks police violence around the country, and Utah's shootings, police shootings, particularly against Black individuals, is on a per capita basis the highest in the nation. So, there are instances where this happens, and I've always tried to emphasize this when I talk about this issue, that, you know, you and I are pretty lucky that we don't have to worry about having to shoot somebody when we go to work. You know, that's not something that you and I are worried about. But, and there are, and as Jessica noted, most of these have been, when they have been investigated, have been deemed justified. And we've seen instances where they call it suicide by cop, right? Where somebody has a gun and wants to be shot, or somebody clearly has a weapon and pointing it at police. There are pretty clear cut cases. And then there are some that are not. And it's, you know, it's those cases that are not clear cut where the changing the legal standard might have some bearing on justice for the families of people who shouldn't have been shot. So, you know, we're talking about a small universe of these or a small subset of these, but in those cases, it's significant if a prosecutor can't bring charges. And as Jessica noted, Singill's sort of bemoaned to the state of the law currently. This is a legal standard that exists all across the country. And he said that if you want different results, you need different law. And Troy Rawlings has echoed that, the Davis County attorney.
Right.
The law as it stands now makes it almost impossible for prosecutors to charge an unjustified shooting. Just because, you know, the prosecutor has to crawl inside the police officer's head and show a jury that, you know, they weren't reasonably at fear when they pulled the trigger, and that's really hard to do when the police officer says they were. It's hard to produce evidence that they were not. So, yeah, there's this case in particular. I mean, it was expedited, as we talked about last week. I believe that it's a bad environment to try to produce justice because the prosecutors are under intense pressure, and he knew somebody, you know, regardless of the outcome, there were going to be people who were very upset. I happen to think that, you know, having looked at the presentation that the DA presented yesterday, that not only legally was this the right call because there was no way he was going to get a prosecution on it, but it was also probably the right call from, that these officers made the right decision, and they were, you know, they did see a gun. He had picked it up repeatedly, with presumably intended to use it because he had raised it to his waist, and it was they feared was going to, you know, getting ready to shoot them. You can't wait too long. These are, you know, in the moment decisions, and I think that certainly had he tried to bring charges on it, this case would have been thrown out in a heartbeat.
A couple of just clarifying questions maybe for Jessica Miller on that. Robert Kirky brought up the, the victim of the shooting, the person who was shot, Bernardo Palacios Carbajal, bringing the gun to his waist. Wasn't that after he was shot several times already? Am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, the way that he was running was a little bit odd. And so the report did kind of note that one of the officers was concerned that he was running with his hands in front of him. And so that could have been like a signal that he was, you know, reaching for his waistband, you know, that there possibly could have been a gun. But as far as like when he's running, he never actually pointed it at the officers. It was after he'd been shot. They'd fired, you know, 6 or 7 times. He fell to the ground and his body kind of turns. And so that's when he points the gun towards them, and then that's when they kept shooting. That's where most of their gunfire happened at that point.
And Jessica, there were some questions during this presentation that Singill gave about why officers didn't choose to use less than lethal force on Palacios Carbajal. Can you address that?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to what they're trained to do, right? Like you meet whatever threat you have with the same amount of force or greater. And so if he has a gun, you know, the officer didn't really contemplate using a taser or, you know, tackling him or any of those other things because they did believe that he had a gun. And also, you know, he's wearing a jacket. It was raining outside. And so the officers didn't believe using a taser would be effective because you kind of have to have those prongs have contact with the suspect's skin. And so there was just concern that then knowing that there was a gun with him, that heightened the concern to where the officer said that they didn't feel like they could use any other less lethal force at that point.
Okay. I said that I wanted to get to the second press conference that you covered yesterday, that of the family and their response and their lawyers. We do need to head to our first break in the show, though, so hang on to that part of the story and we will come back to it. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and on Utah Public Radio in Logan. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll be back after a quick one-minute break.
An unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed
on
by
the next radio lab.
How many people do we see killed by the police each year?
Are police shooting more black people than white people? We don't know.
There's no national statistics on.
No one keeps accurate statistics on police shootings.
I've met 400 other mothers who's lost their children.
I cannot believe that my profession, in some cases, is that out of control.
That's on the next radio lab.
Tomorrow at noon on UPR.
Make an appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health. It'll be a jam-packed hour in healthy living, including this recipe for...
delicious beer-battered smelt.
We always have a great time, so will you on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX.
That's Sundays at noon here on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jessica Miller and by news columnist Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255 or tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Jessica Miller, we were talking about the decision by the Salt Lake County District Attorney and the police shooting death of Bernardo Palacios Carbajal and the aftermath of that determination. I wanted to ask you about the second press conference that you attended yesterday, and that was held by the family of Bernardo Palacios Carbajal and by the attorneys of the family. And Jessica, they wanted DA Sim Gill to bring charges as part of their pursuit of justice for their son. And their brother, so they weren't happy with this outcome. That's obviously safe to say, right?
Yeah, that's probably an understatement.
Right. Well, what happened? I mean, they held a press conference. What was it that they said that they are going to do? They want to keep pushing for change. Also, talking about a lawsuit to try and change things as well.
Right. Yeah, they are planning to bring a lawsuit against the police department, but you know, they said that they want to keep working to push for change, and that, you know, to them that means the Salt Lake City Police Department alters their policies and training, and you know, some state legislators have promised criminal justice reform, in you know, not just with this shooting, but with this whole movement that's going on right now, as we're discussing, you know, racial bias and policing and things like that. And so they, you know, are hoping to kind of hold state legislators to those promises. And at the end of the day, they do want those officers to be held accountable. And so I think that they'll still pursue avenues for that, whether it's a civil lawsuit, whether it's trying to get another review with the Attorney General's office or some other way. That's really their goal, is to try to bring some sort of justice to them, is seeing those two cops that shot their son and brother to face some sort of consequence.
And I guess, how did they address, or, and this is a tough question as well, but how did the attorneys for the family address the justification that was used not to charge the two officers? I mean, did they talk about that?
Yeah, so the attorney said, you know, that they never should have fired to begin with, that Palacios Carbajal was clearly running away. He had ample opportunity. If his intent was to harm the police officers, you know, he could have done that easily before this. But, you know, all he was doing was running away. And so they made the argument that didn't justify deadly force. And then once they did shoot him, excuse me, and he fell to the ground, that he was no longer a threat. And so to continue to keep firing upon him, even though he clearly had been injured, he was on the ground, but that was excessive force. So that was way more than needed to be used in that moment.
And that's a that's a standard under which officers could conceivably be have been charged by District Attorney Sim Gill. What we are spending a lot of time on this one story, but I think that it's an important story to try and grapple with. And I want to get to Robert Gerke's suggestions on how to if this is what we want, how we might hold police accountable. But what, just Jessica, what is happening with these two officers? I mean, they're on the job, right? And from the police's perspective, they did their job in this instance. Is that right?
Well, the reviews aren't quite over yet. excuse me. So now what happens is the police department will have their own internal investigation. So that might be where you could see, like, if they acted outside of their handbook or whatnot, they could face some sort of disciplinary action from within the department. And then also Salt Lake City has a civilian review board, and so they will also look at the case and make a determination about whether the use of force was justified. Obviously, they have no power to bring a case to the courtroom or anything like that, but there is going to be some more review processes that go on, in particular with this one case and those two officers.
Okay. There's more I want to get to, including the reaction of city leaders and how and the state itself and police. But Robert Gerke, to you, in a column this week, you had some you've talked about some of this already, but you had some suggestions to perhaps change things so that police, in those instances where a police officer, you know, does shoot without justification, they can be held accountable. And you had seven suggestions. Actually, before we go to those suggestions, you write that the majority of these shootings really are justified. I mean, we live in a country with a lot more guns than people, and some of those guns are used in crimes and get pointed at police or fired at police. Do you want to talk about that first, and then we can go on to
that? Well, I mean, we kind of touched on that when Jessica said that when these shootings are investigated, they're almost all but six, I believe, who have been deemed justified. And so, you know, even if we disagree that, you know, there are maybe some others that are on the borderline, the majority, the vast majority of them are justified. And so but when we talk about, you know, wanting to be able to charge those cases where they're not, we're going to need to change the laws. We keep coming back to that. You know, and the one thing I think that we could do is sort of readjust this threshold for what we consider to be legally justified shootings, because, you know, it seems out of balance right now. And so, you know, in the Ninth Circuit, there have been some cases where they've allowed juries to consider the events that preceded the shooting. For example, if the officer initiated the contact or escalated the conflict to the point where the shooting became necessary, then that could be taken into account. Or, as you guys were discussing, the use of the taser, which in this case, obviously, they said was not a consideration. But what if in those cases it is an option that they chose not to use? The proportionality of the force, it can be considered. So that's one thing that can be done. I think the investigation of these should not be done by police departments the way it works right now, say in Davis County. If a Farmington officer shoots somebody, the neighboring jurisdictions will form an investigative unit. And those officers often know the officer they're investigating, or at least know officers in that department. And so for the purposes of public confidence, it would make sense to have a state-level investigative unit. And I don't know if you put that in the Attorney General's office or Department of Public Safety, or have it completely separate. But just so you have people who are not necessarily don't have ties to that department or that officer doing the investigation. And that's especially true in rural counties where they don't necessarily have as many officers. They're, you know, smaller, closer knit, et cetera. And then you can talk about, you know, you mentioned the civil suit that Palacio Carvajal's family is looking at filing. Qualified immunity is a huge barrier to those civil lawsuits. And so that's one of the things, that's a protection that's given to public officials, generally speaking, but is used in these police cases to say, unless they're, you know, egregiously out of line in their conduct, they can't be held civilly responsible. And so that's something that's getting broad discussion across the country that would probably take an act of Congress, because these lawsuits are brought in federal court for civil rights violations. But it's a discussion we need to have about tweaking that. And I also say that, you know, to if we want to reduce the number of police shootings, we need to pay officers better to get better officers. And you can also do something about, you know, trying to fund the social safety net that's been, you know, chopped away. And because these police officers are put in positions where they're mental health, you know, therapists, they're, you know, homeless resource coordinators. They do all these, they've been tasked with all of these responsibilities that frankly they're not trained to do. And in about 20-25% of police shootings across the country, the victim suffers from a mental illness. And so, it's an issue that can be addressed separate from, how we prosecute shootings to try to alleviate or avoid some shootings before they happen.
There's a lot. Your column includes a case that I think is still under review, the story of Chad Breinholt that almost seemed like an execution. There's a lot of public pressure, a lot of focus right now on police. Are the reforms that you are suggesting, Robert, in your column, or that you've compiled, I guess, in your column, are they getting traction locally? I mean, you mentioned the fact that at the national level, there might have to be an act of Congress for a certain change. But
for the qualified
immunity. But otherwise, is there going to be a wide adoption of changes?
Well, there are discussions that are going on and that are beginning with the League of Cities and Towns and Association of Counties and the Statewide Association of Prosecutors to look at these. I think there's a big obstacle, and that is that the police union in every state, but also in Utah, has so much clout and opposes anything that would expose their officers to more potential liability. And so that's the obstacle they're going to have to overcome if anything of substance is going to happen. And I'm a little bit skeptical that it will, just because, as I mentioned, these police unions wield a lot of power, and I've been able in the past to make the argument that if you start, changing the standards, the officers aren't going to want to do the job. They're going to think, they're going to hesitate and get shot. Those are the arguments they make, and so that's the obstacle they'll have to overcome.
Jessica Miller, how political leaders, city leaders, the police chief here in Salt Lake City, the mayor, the city council, how they view these reform proposals, especially when it comes to, maybe changing that statute having to do with an officer reasonably believing that there's a threat that would seem to prevent some of, in some instances, accountability. How are city leaders responding to the push to change that?
It's something that they've said that they'll consider. The chief yesterday put out a statement pretty much supporting the officers, and then put out a later statement in the evening as the protests were going on last night. They got the protesters and the police clashed a little bit last night at the protest, and so some of the responses that we saw were actually in response to what happened later in the evening, and not as much the decision itself.
Okay. There was a statement from the Mayor's Commission on Racial Equity in Policing. It's a very new commission, but that read in part, today, our communities of color are tired after lifetimes of repeatedly asking for change. In the wake of tragedies, the outcomes have become unfortunately predictable. And then it goes on to say, as acknowledged by the Salt Lake County District Attorney himself today, our standards for deadly force are too broad. There is a gap in this instance and in other policies and practices, both in Salt Lake City and throughout the state, between what is legal and what is truly right and just. And that is a commission that was formed in the wake of the national conversation about police reform and police violence in the wake of the death of George Floyd. Jessica Miller, we could spend the whole hour on this, but I think we need to move on to some other stories. So I'll just say thank you very much for covering this. And I'll remind listeners that you are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporters and columnists from the Salt Lake Tribune. You can join us by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Let's move on to the other story that has been dominating the front pages this summer, the pandemic. Wednesday saw our highest single-day increase in cases since the start of the pandemic, with 722 new cases. That coincided with 7 additional deaths over the previous day. Yesterday, 600 new cases and 4 new deaths. And while it's true that testing has been increasing, if you go over to the state's coronavirus dashboard, you can also see that the percentage of positives of those tested has also been increasing. And in the face of this troubling scenario, Governor Gary Herbert has been receiving calls to institute a statewide mask mandate. As it currently stands, he has been approving municipalities or counties' requests to implement a ban. But there have been signs that he was considering a statewide ban. Yesterday, however, he said that wasn't going to happen. Instead, he mandated that masks be worn by everyone who works at, visits, or attends a K through 12 school in the state. I'm going to play a few clips, a sampling of what the governor had to say during the coronavirus briefing by the governor and by Dr. Angela Dunn, the state epidemiologist, yesterday. And then we'll come back for the commentary that that you're all waiting for from news columnist Robert Gierke. But this is sort of an audio postcard from the governor's comments from yesterday. Take a listen.
Parents should expect that their children are going to a safe environment. Teachers, principals, staff members at the school should anticipate and expect that they're going to be involved in a safe environment. So to that end, I'm announcing that we are mandating that all students, faculty, staff, and visitors to our K through 12 schools throughout this state, our 41 school districts, our charter schools, will wear a mask in the buildings and on the bus. But we're at a somewhat of a crossroads right now as far as, you know, what do we do? Again, our infection rates are up, and as I've mentioned, that cannot stand. We've got to, in fact, turn those infection rates around, or our hospital system, our healthcare is going to, in fact, become overwhelmed. Right now, we're at 585 a day. Our infection rate is at 9.9%. Again, we were down at 4, so we've more than doubled our infection rate, and we've more than doubled our number of cases that have taken place. We have the constitutional authority to mandate this. Certainly working with our state health department, this is an issue that's been tested under the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. The Supreme Court has weighed in on this a number of times, saying we have the ability to make this a mandate. At this time, I choose not to make it a mandate. I'm going to give the people of Utah an opportunity to show the kind of people and the character that they are, which I believe we've demonstrated in times past. It's time for us to, in fact, say, you know what, for the good of the whole, we're going to comply voluntarily to wear face coverings. There is really no excuse for all of us to not wear face coverings and a mask to help protect against the spreading of the coronavirus. If we don't, we all know what the ultimate results of not complying and not being able to, in fact, flatten the curve and reduce the infection rate. We'll have the disappointing decision of having to make, do we in fact roll back the economy, go from yellow to orange, for example, or mandating the use of masks? Those are the options that are ahead of us. I choose to say, let's let the people, in fact, make those decisions.
Again, that's Governor Gary Herbert yesterday announcing a mask mandate for K through 12 schools, but not for the state as a whole. And I'll mention as well that he issued a challenge. He wants Utah to get to 500 cases per day by August 1st, but he wants that to happen through people choosing to act. Robert Gierke, Salt Lake Tribune news columnist, a challenge, not a mandate from the governor. Much of this has to do with his philosophy of what government is and should do. Is that an accurate statement on my part?
Yeah, I think that's kind of what it comes down to. You've got governor's under a lot of pressure from, you know, both sides, from the people who are calling on him to wear a mask, to issue a mask mandate, the business community, the faith community, medical community, all have urged him to mandate wearing a mask. But you've got a group of Republicans in the legislature who oppose that. And we saw a statement from the House Speaker and Senate President just the night before the governor made these comments, saying that they oppose a mask mandate. And so the legislature happens to hold wield most of the power in this. And if the governor were to issue a mask mandate, I think it's likely it would get reversed by the legislature. That doesn't mean he couldn't, you know, he couldn't stand up to them or try to stand up to them or try to convince the public to convince their legislators to do it, but he chose not to do that. I think, frankly, that a statewide mask mandate may not be necessary because we still have health districts that aren't seeing a lot of cases. But in those that are, you know, masks work. And I think anybody who lives in Salt Lake City or Salt Lake County, since the mandate went into effect June 25th, has seen a fairly drastic change in the utilization of masks. You used to go to places and see, you know, now half or more people who are not wearing them now. I think it's rare that you see somebody who's not when you're in a store or so forth. So you know, it works. And having simply asking people, we saw it didn't work. So in those instances where there's a lot of cases and masks are not being utilized, a mandate would make sense, one would think. But there's no reason to think that asking people again is going to make any difference. And I think that I think the governor's goal or challenge to get down to 500 cases is fairly unrealistic, because we're not doing anything different than we were doing before. And we haven't seen, throughout the course of this viral spread, we haven't seen the number of cases dip at all. They've gone up and up and up, especially since Memorial Day. And so, you know, to think that trend is suddenly going to somehow reverse when we're not doing anything different, I think, is completely unrealistic. And we're going to see the cases continue to rise and hospitals continue to be strained. So it's not a real rosy picture right now. And unfortunately, because of the politics in the state, we're not going to see any action taken by the state to try to deter that.
It's interesting, that 500 per day number that we're trying to get to, which is 300 more than what Dr. Angela Dunn was recommending just a month ago that we get to by the 1st of July. He's trying to get to 500 per day by the 1st of August. That seems, maybe that's more doable than the 200 number was, but the business community, the faith community, the health community, I mean, those are three. That's what communities are left, Robert, who are not advocating, other than the legislature, for that mask mandate. I think that an interesting comparison to make here is with, you know, seatbelts or with drunk driving laws. They are mandated by law in Utah, the seatbelts in particular, since 1986. But the debate over that at the time had to do with the role of government and personal responsibility. Seatbelts, though, impact individual personal safety. Masks are about broader public safety. A question that I wanted to ask the governor yesterday during the press conference was whether he would have opposed the passage of seatbelt laws, favoring instead that personal responsibility approach, which is, again, what many lawmakers were saying back in the mid-80s. And, of course, there are still states that don't mandate seatbelts, but Utah does. That's not much of a question. I didn't get a chance to ask it. I will try and ask it in the future. Go ahead, Gerke. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll just piggyback on it a little bit. I mean, You made a very good point that that's about individual safety. This is about the health and welfare of potentially thousands of people. That's a smaller group of people, and I think it's the arguments against wearing a mask, I think, are you know, pretty flimsy. You know, but there is a group of people who say that the government can't tell us what to do. Government tells us what we can and can't do quite a bit, but you know, they think that this is a bridge too far, and the whole issue, unfortunately, has become politicized. It's not about, you know, the governor couched it, I think, appropriately in making a small sacrifice or suffering a small inconvenience to benefit those around us. That's how this should be couched. But yeah, Unfortunately, it's turned into a large political issue where people are purposely not wearing masks to make a political statement. And I think it's really unfortunate and it's dangerous.
Robert Gerke, well, it sounded like from the press conference that there's the idea that there might be a mandate down the road, depending upon what happens. I mean, we'll see. But at the moment, we're going to have to leave that story behind and turn already to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week, to save time for a conversation with Kathy Stevenson about alcohol policy, the closure of a much loved restaurant, and more. But there's a lot of other stories to choose from, seeing as how we only tackled two stories on the show. Jessica Miller will bring you back in for an underplayed story of the week pick. Are you ready?
I am ready. I did some reporting earlier this week about coronavirus in our jails and prisons. There has been two facilities. Weber County has had 82 inmates who have tested positive, and Washington County had closer to 100. So we've been doing some reporting this week about just the outbreaks at these two facilities and what the officials are trying to do to stop that from spreading.
Okay, great pick from Jessica Miller. Thank you so much. Robert Gerke, your choice for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, I think this one was kind of interesting. Tommy Berg took a look at the Paycheck Protection Plan loans that were given out in Utah. And you know, as you might expect, they were very broadly utilized, but there were some interesting ones in there. A couple legislators got loans, including House Speaker Brad Wilson's Destination Homes. And, you know, you had everything from Blue Boutique to Squatty Potty to the Czech City payday loan franchise that took that a loan itself, although it got a much better interest rate than it gives. So you can probably take a look at that and just for, you know, just see who in Utah is utilizing this program, which the Treasury Department says has saved about 800,000 jobs in Utah. So.
All right. Check that out at sltrip.com. I'm going to forego my pick in the interest of time. And I will just say to Jessica Miller and Robert Gerke, thanks very much for joining me on the show.
Of course. Thanks, Roger.
We are going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we will turn to our final segment, a conversation with Kathy Stevenson. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
This is Debbie Andrew. As a service to you, Utah Public Radio is providing on-air and online resources for ways you can take advantage of social distance recreating in your hometown. Representatives from Davis, Garfield, Cache, and other tourism areas are sharing ideas about unique hiking trails, scenic drives, and places to grab an on-the-go bite to eat. If you missed the message here, you can always get more information on our Project Resilience webpage. Find the link online at upr.org.
My name is Martha Hamm, and I listen at 90.9 in St. George, Utah.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and for the remainder of the show, we are going to turn to the Tribune's Kathy Stevenson for a look at some recent alcohol and dining news. Take a listen. Kathy Stevenson, food, alcohol, dining, and cool old neon signs reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me today.
Oh, glad to be here. Thanks.
We're going to tackle three items that you covered this week. The first I want to turn to is that some lawmakers and a number of businesses in the state want to see Utah's liquor laws or their enforcement maybe adjusted because of the pandemic. A couple of Democratic lawmakers sent a letter to Utah Governor Gary Herbert. What is it that they want to see, or what are they advocating for, Kathy?
You know, people want to be able to pick up beer at the grocery store through curbside pickup, right? I mean, you order online, you order your bread, your milk, your toilet paper, but you cannot really order beer and have it picked up. You have to go into the store to pick up the beer and buy it.
Which totally eliminates the whole point of the curbside pickup during a pandemic.
Yes, yeah. Okay. Yes. So they're saying it doesn't have to be permanent. It can just be temporary while we're in these kind of color-coded zones. Why not let grocery stores deliver it to your car? They can check your ID with the scanner, just like they do at the cash register. It's just, you know, 50 feet from the door instead of inside the store. Throughout the whole pandemic, the Grocery Association has wanted this, consumers have wanted this, and even other states have changed their laws. So it's not like Utah has this strange law. Other states have it, but other states have been willing to kind of forego it during the pandemic because they want people to be safe, right? Don't go in the store if you don't have to.
Yeah.
So, but.
And so the letter was from Senator Derek Kitchen and from Representative Joel Briscoe, both Democrats, mm-hmm. and they want that to be allowed to happen. Representative Briscoe also mentioned this letter that he got from one of his constituents, an 85-year-old man who's frustrated that he can't get beer delivered to his house, right?
Yes. Now, beer delivery seems a little step beyond, like, I think, you know, that's one more thing getting it delivered. I mean, we talked about that in the legislature, even having wine clubs, remember back in February and March, we talked about
there's
a bill to have, you know, wine delivered to your house. It passed, but it's letting the DAVC create their own system. And it wouldn't be delivered to your house. You'd have to go pick it up at the liquor store. So Utah is not ready for home delivery of alcohol.
Okay. But potentially, yeah, you're right. That's because you have the kind of teetotaling lawmakers who are scared of losing control of who's getting the alcohol, but
the kids might get beer delivered
through Amazon or whatever.
I mean, I get it.
But why not curbside delivery right now? I mean, that's not allowed currently because of the same fear that it might.
You know, just taking it outside the store where people can't check. Maybe that's it. I mean, this has come up. The Grocery Manufacturers Association has been fighting this like for 3 years, ever since, you know, Smith's and everybody started their click it lists and pickup. This became an issue. And they were like, hey, this is one thing that we can't do. We can't pick up beer. And so they've asked lawmakers for like 3 years in a row, and there's been no action on it.
And the answer is just to have people checking IDs when you do the pickup.
Checking IDs, and they don't want kids. I don't know. I do think it's the underage drinking thing, but I'm not exactly sure why. Okay. I don't know that there's ever been a good explanation. So maybe that should be my next story. Why is this not? And I don't know.
Yeah. You know, Kathy, before we move on to other stories, do we have any word from on high, from the governor's office, as to whether that kind of variance that would allow curbside pickup to happen? I mean, because the governor would basically have to say, you know what, we're going to make this exception.
The governor could do it as an executive order. He wouldn't have to go through the legislature. No.
And he commented on that?
They were supposed to meet this Tuesday with legislative leaders, and I have heard nothing of what has come of that. So.
Okay. Okay.
Well, we've been busy with masks.
Right. It has been. You're right. Exactly. We talked about that on the show earlier.
So,
let's move on then to other stories. Story number two, the pandemic has taken a toll on neighborhood businesses. And on one in particular this week, a restaurant in Salt Lake City's 9th and 9th neighborhood is closing for good. Maza Middle Eastern, Kathy.
Yeah. It's, you know, Maza is a favorite spot. I mean, the first one opened 20 years ago on 15th and 15th, and it was an immediate hit. Everybody loved the falafel and the shawarma and the lamb. I think it was one of the first places I was thinking lamb's on the menu, you know? So then he expanded to 9th and 9th, and then just this last year, he opened in Sandy, Ali. But in the pandemic, he's closed everything, and I think he just sees the future that people are just not going to be going out as much in the future. So he just said the 9th and 9th location, because he leases it, was the easiest to close, even though it has been closed since mid-March when all the restaurants shut down. I had been hearing people say, I think it's closing. And it's hard to tell what restaurants are closing and which ones are just closed because they don't have employees or the employees don't want to come to work. So it's not quite clear, but I knew that would be especially hard on that neighborhood and for Salt Lake City in general.
I should mention for disclosure's sake that Maza is a longtime business underwriter with KCPW. Ali Sabah says that it's just not working. I mean, he has these other locations, as you mentioned, Sandy and then the 15th and 15th original.
15th has been open and doing takeout, and he says that's been great. And then he's going to open Sandy, which is a larger space, and he can do the spread out tables and has a patio and outside seating. But just the lease, he said, because I lease it, it's easier to sublease, and that neighborhood is so popular, right? It's gonna
Well, is it though? I mean, the question is, who would take over? I mean, the restaurant business, as you just pointed out, is already hard enough, and the pandemic makes it quite a bit more difficult to work. Does it have to be a restaurant? Maybe you don't know that answer, but I mean,
I don't know. I guess it could be. I mean, you wouldn't have to go in and remodel or anything. It's really beautiful in there with tables and all the equipment. Right across the street, Vessel Kitchen opened about a month ago and is killing it. So, I am confused by all the things going on. It is like no other time right? People are supporting restaurants. They're doing takeout. Some people are eating in now, but some people aren't ready to do that. And so it's just this kind of...
It's this weird in-between time.
It is a weird in-between time. I think we will see more of this, though. I don't think restaurants can really survive much longer. Some of them won't be able to survive much longer. I mean, the predictions are at least a quarter of all the restaurants will close. So...
And this particular closure will change the feel of the 9th and 9th, neighborhood a little bit. Well, let's move on to our last story, Kathy, which might not seem like the best story for radio, but the restoration of a cool old sign, I mentioned that that's part of your beat now, it might seem kind of silly to talk about, but some of the details in your story were really interesting. First off, this is a relatively old piece of artwork from the 1950s?
Yeah, the Cotton Bottom Inn opened in the 1950s, and the sign has been up since then. Neon, you know, that's kind of the traditional time. It has neon, it has the rabbit, it has the cotton bottom. But the lights didn't work for very long, it sounds like. And then, you know, as time goes on, that sign...
Wait, would you actually describe the sign for people who have no idea what we're talking about here? Listeners?
It's got a kind of a round piece with... It looks like Bugs Bunny.
Yes.
Holding a mug of beer, foaming mug of beer, kind of blue. And then the kind of a wood-looking sign that says the Cotton Bottom Inn. And so it's kind of been the, you know, landmark there in Holiday for a long time. But new owners have come in and they are remodeling the tavern and adding more space, more dining space. And so as part of that, they took down the sign and had Brimley Neon restore it. And it took about 6 months, about 80 hours. And they said, there's little holes in it. And they always thought they were bullet holes. But when they pulled it down and looked at it, they were really arrows, like people had been shooting archery bow and arrows at it. Wow. And one of the arrows is stuck in there and they were afraid to take it out or it would ruin the glass. So there is an arrow stuck in it. There was a whole bunch of, you know, dirt and bird's nests and wasp things inside of it. They pulled out about 40 pounds, they said. And then when they repainted it, it looked bright and shiny. And the new owner said, oh, that we want it more aged looking. So they antiqued it. So I like those kind of stories. I think they're fun. I'm glad they save a piece of history.
The photograph is really cool to look at too, that accompanies your story. You know, you mentioned the fact that that new owners are going in, that they're remodeling, and as part of the remodel, they refurbish this sign. We just talked about Mazza closing its 9th and 9th location. Is refurbishing an old bar and restaurant a risky endeavor right now? And who's behind it, Kathy?
So the people behind it are the same people, Ty Burrell and family, if you know Modern Family, his brother-in-laws and brothers, and it's a group who also owns the Bar X and the Beer Bar and the eating establishment in Park City. And so they have some capital behind them to do this. They have some history of taking iconic Utah places and saving them and restoring them. So they've got a little history. I think it helps them that they have not had to worry about closing down and trying to separate tables. And so I kind of think if you're in the construction business, I mean, you're probably fine. They probably have the money and they just keep going. When it will open might be an interesting thing. They say this fall, but
who's to say? Do they have outside? Will they have outside seating? It seems like that's an important component of any. Okay.
Yes, I believe so. They're trying to keep the old tavern as is, but they're adding a dining room, more restaurant, so it's for, you know, families can take their kids. So it's supposed to be bigger. So that might help them. I'm not predicting anything anymore. I just can't do that.
Right. Who knows? Who knows what the future holds?
And yeah, people ask me, I'm like, all bets are off. Who knows what the world is going to do?
Well, and here we are. Kathy Stevenson is covering a beat that is in flux. And Kathy Stevenson is with the Salt Lake Tribune and covers food, alcohol, dining, and more. Thanks again for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah. And that's it for Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Please join us again next week.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.